listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
It's so good to be with you. In studio today is Father Tim Grumbaugh from St. Augustine Parish in Los Angeles. And we have an action-packed show. We're finally going to be talking about the movie Bird Box that came out a couple months ago. And we'll have some interesting takes and commentary on that. I know a little late to the game, but I've just wondered, why has there been such a cultural phenomenon over this movie? And I think there's a lot to that.
And I think it'll be good now that we're separated a little bit from that cultural phenomenon to analyze it a little bit and see the way that stories reach into our culture. They come out of our culture, they reach back into it. And, we had an interesting chat over the last couple of days about why this might be such an interest in the culture to look at this movie Bird Box. You know, what are movies anyways? I haven't seen a movie in like 3 weeks or something like that. So
Father's in the middle of the Exodus 90 fast. No movie, no social media, except for a brief live appearance on all social media platforms today for Trending. We'll also be talking about the legal system here in the United States and how we're falling away from the natural law and religious roots that really unified us and made us a very virtuous and moral country in many ways. We'll be talking about religious tests and how many people running for office are now facing this challenge, but also maybe you in your own work sphere are having to be careful with what you say in the workplace. We'll get to, more importantly in the area of work as well, is raising a young person with a hard work ethic. Is that enough? Because I think this is a really important question today and something I'm seeing have long-term impact. So Father Tim and I are starting off with the movie Bird Box. Now, I'll get to it later, but I'm actually going to make a full disclosure. I stopped watching the movie with about 30 minutes to go. And there's a reason personally on my part. I'm like, I've had enough. I'm done. I had the rest of the movie explained to me. Boom, we're done. I'll tell you why if you just stick around for a bit. But your first impressions off the movie Bird Box, Father Tim?
I enjoyed it, but I don't think it really did much to change my life. It was a lot of reflection afterwards to say, you know, what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it. And just over the last couple of days to reflect on it a little bit more, I see there are a lot of great themes that it could have touched on. And the most you can learn from the movie is, you know, from those themes that it actually didn't touch on. So what was lacking?
Or maybe what it didn't play out fully.
Right,
it was
right,
a lot of reading between the lines in certain areas, which I know some people like this, like, oh, I can put my own interpretation on anything that I want. And maybe that's why some people like modern art, but that's relativism. And I felt that way in many ways about this movie.
I'm glad that you brought that word up, relativism, because that was a part of my reflection yesterday was, Pope Benedict's powerful words about the dictatorship of relativism, how, those who adhere to relativism are using it as a dictatorship that almost in the sense, and I'll go into this in a little bit more soon, is, they feel like maybe they face religion that doesn't allow them to ask questions, doesn't allow them to question, doesn't have any answers. But then they use relativism very much in the same way, is, no, you don't get to ask questions about what I believe.
So at the same time as you have your own meaning, you can't question someone else's meaning.
Right, that's right.
It's very present. So we're talking about the movie Bird Box with Sandra Bullock in it, and it is featured on Netflix. So unless you're part of the Netflix universe, you might be missing out. But I'm going to say you're not missing that much. And actually, personally, I don't know that I'd recommend watching the movie. And I'll tell you why. I actually chose not to finish watching it. And I know this is a great thriller. There's a lot of, I guess you could say, suspense to it. But
which we're going to spoil, by the way. So spoiler alert,
okay,
I think, would be fair to say.
Yeah, spoiler alert for the movie. If you haven't seen it, it's been 2 months. Like me, like you can ruin it for me. It's okay. I always think of spoiler alerts now because my brother ruined the fact that Han Solo died in one of the newer Star Wars movies. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What, Oliver? He's like, huh? And he like makes his face looking at me like big deer in headlights, like, what are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, like I wish he was lying, right? Yeah, yeah.
He wished he was lying too. He felt pretty bad. He's like, well, I thought you would have seen it by now.
Yeah.
Great moment. That's Brother Tim Grumbach. I'm Tim Ray Millington. So here's a story. I would say my overall, like, looking at the story, Mallory's the main character, is played by Sandra Bullock, and it's very clear that she almost has this like detachment disorder. She's pregnant, she's expecting a child, but she's not really looking forward to it. But my take on it is that she fears this lonely responsibility of carrying this responsibility alone, which is why I think when she is about to give birth to the baby and suddenly her water breaks and they're in the midst of this horror of, you know, all of these people. The premise of the story is that there's this terror that's kind of possessing people, and everyone who sees it, if they're outside, becomes possessed to the point where they commit suicide.
Yes, and there's this description about, you know, a third of the way through the movie of what this might be. There's no explanation. There's no origin given, and you could say there's even no resolution given by the end of the movie, which we can talk a little bit more about, is that, and that kind of opens up the doors for your own interpretation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll get into why I don't think that's a very good way of telling stories to begin with, or a helpful way of telling stories. But, you know, again, my first take a little bit more is that, you know, a lot of the characters are very forgettable. And the characters that you remember may remember most are because they just plain disappeared and never showed up. And you're like, were they just there? You know, there were a couple of characters that, like, you know, ended up, let's say, getting intimates. And it was just as if, like, the only reason that they were in the story to begin with was so you could see a little bit of skin.
Yeah.
And it's like, those characters are so forgettable. I could have done without them, completely without them. And so, you know, forgettable characters are not, you know, my favorite part of any story. And then,
well, and then there's some characters where, like, I would have loved to see where this went further, mm-hmm. but then they die so early on. It just reminded me in some ways of the attitude of the books A Series of Unfortunate Events mm-hmm. by Lemony Snicket. Like, there's no good resolution. There's no development of the person. And in the end, you read 12 books and it's still the same exact situation. Mm-hmm. Hopeless mm-hmm. in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that's what the writers were going for, was to develop such a sense of hopelessness by giving us characters that are forgettable. I don't want to give them that much credit.
you're like, they're just yeah. dumb writers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also another problem that I had with the writing was it's going back, you know, back and forth, you know, between the present and the past and the present and the past. And when that is done well, the past can explain what's happening in the present.
Yes.
But it just seems so awkward, these transitions between, you know, what's happening now and yeah. what happened in the past. It doesn't feel like anything is explaining itself. It just...
There was no comparison to Once Upon a Time season one.
Oh,
let's
right.
be
yes.
honest.
Oh, not even close.
Oh, man. Yeah, remember yeah. the first couple of seasons? I think they're still making it. They like kind of rebooted it in some
yeah,
ways.
Yeah.
They lost me a while back, but the flashbacks were awesome in Once mm-hmm. Upon a Time. Mm-hmm. I digress. One of the things, though, with her motherhood, so that puts it into context. She has this like detachment disorder. She's not looking forward to the baby. I think it's out of this fear of like she's doing this by herself. And what ends up happening is she's kind of finds a safe haven of a handful of other people. And suddenly she goes into labor. Her water breaks. And she's saying, not now. Mm-hmm. Like, this is her response. And I don't think it's just because of the presence around her that's creating all of this suicide and chaos. I think it's because she was already afraid to be alone taking on the burden of raising the child. But now she's going, I have a responsibility for this kid. I don't want to bring this kid into this. Not now. And I think that resonates throughout the story because she ends up alone at the very end, taking these two children to the safe haven.
Right. And that reaches into our society right now of, you know, it's almost a default position of, oh, it's not a good time for a child. You know, not now, not now. And though we know in our Catholic teaching that, you know, there's a legitimate way to handle that within, you know, the discernment of husband and wife of what is a good time to be able to bear children. But it's almost a default position of, you know, children are a burden, you know, because it's going to get in the way of my life and whatnot. And so I think that she expresses this by putting up these, you know, these impenetrable protections against relationships throughout the whole story.
See, but that's the thing. I keep hearing people say that she puts up these walls against relationships. Yeah, I see her care very deeply and the love she has for the other pregnant woman. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It's interesting because Sandra Bullock's character in Mallory is someone who's very tough. She grew up on a farm. And I remember at one point she's talking to the pregnant lady. And as she's talking to her, she's talking about how, like, she's always the one girl, the other pregnant lady, like, let's just say overweight, kind of soft, a little bit of a wimp in some ways. And she admits that she's always been spoiled and she's kind of apologizing because she's recognizing she's a bit of a burden. And here's Mallory, really tough, knows how to shoot a gun, help protect people in the situation. And in comparison, Mallory basically says she doesn't really have that option. She said she was raised by wolves. And then she goes on to be so compassionate to the other pregnant woman, Olivia. And in my mind, I'm thinking, Mallory's someone who's really tough, and this is a type of person who could really get annoyed by someone who maybe is kind of weak, soft, not really helping themselves, and really turning themselves in some cases into a burden in the situation. But instead, Mallory's very feeling and gentle and doesn't allow herself to have that tough demeanor toward this other woman.
Right. And so what I can see in that, and you know, was that she is very much able to show that care and to show that love, but she finds it so terribly difficult to receive it. That's the take I was getting in the protections that she puts up, is that she's not incapable of love, but being loved was very difficult for her, especially as she takes the two children to take them to the safe haven, to the sanctuary. We've kind of laughed about it as a culture, is, you know, she names them boy and girl. Yeah. She doesn't give them names. And we know, you know, just scripturally and in our own experience, the power that a name can have.
Yeah.
And so to deprive these children of, you know, what we might consider regular names, but it is almost as if she's protecting herself from getting too close to these kids because she knows how likely it is that she's going to lose them. Yeah. And, you know, there comes a point where they're on the river and she almost has to make a decision about which one is going to look and guide them and be in danger of seeing these monsters, these
because
things
if, that... Because yeah. if you open your eyes outside,
right.
you're likely going to become possessed
right.
and promote this like evil presence, or mm-hmm. you're going to end up committing suicide.
Right, right.
So
yes.
she's having to choose between the two of who's uh-huh. going to look in the river.
Yeah, yeah. And so she obviously is capable of love and care in a very tough way. And, you know, she makes a decision to just... you know, risk the danger of the river without forcing one of the children to look. But the fact that she will not name the children until she feels that they're safe at the end of the story, it shows a lot of the, I think, a modern mentality of, you know, I'm not going to love until I know it's going to be safe.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not going to invest completely, you know, totally faithfully, fruitfully, you know, just completely and freely until I know it's going to be safe for me and safe for them. You know, we can see this in a lot of the, you know, pro-life against pro-abortion discussion is, you know, one, personhood. When is a person a person? But also, you know, when is it going to be convenient for me to love? You know, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the important and difficult questions that always gets asked. But I want to go to a quote from C.S. Lewis. It's the so famous, this quote about what love is and the vulnerability that comes with love.
That's Father Tim Grumbach, by the way. I'm Timmy Millington. You're listening to Trending. So what's this quote from C.S. Lewis that points to this love that is so necessary in the mm-hmm. movie that's missing in the main
right.
character from Bird Box that Sandra Bullock plays as Mallory?
Yeah, it begins with, to love is to be vulnerable. And then he continues, love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell.
It's incredible reading this quote. I read it in Bishop Olmsted's letter that we went through in our last episode together titled Complete My Joy. It's a letter to families. And he's talking about how many people have this difficult time loving today. And he quotes this quote from C.S. Lewis that Father Tim just quoted. And it's so true. Like, if you're going to open yourself up to love, you're going to get hurt. But sometimes it's in the broken pieces that we are able to love all the more. But if we don't allow ourselves to love, we're going to be so closed off, so distracted, seeking all these different things. We're creating a living hell for ourselves, is what C.S. Lewis is getting at.
Right, right. Yeah. And ultimately, it's not just a figurative image of hell. He says this is hell. This is what hell will be like, is you're protected from love because you're protected from vulnerability, protected from the risk of having your heart broken. You can have that in heaven too, but that means you have to live vulnerably now and stay open to that vulnerability, and that love will never end in heaven. Mm-hmm. That quote struck me when I was watching this movie, you know, even a couple months ago, was, you know, she's afraid of getting so close to these kids as to name them because she knows how likely it is that she'll lose them. But she fights for them. And so it's clear that she loves them and cares for them and in a tough way.
And she makes it clear that every decision, because at one point, her kind of counterpart, she ends up encountering a man named Tom who was a Marine. And from the get-go, he has this desire to protect her and to protect the children. And I mean, it's just a stranger she meets in the midst of all of the suicide that's taking place around her. And, you know, right away, he has this like desire to touch her pregnant belly, and eventually she ends up softening enough to say, okay, here, you know, here, and she sets his hand on her stomach. But it's really neat to see that he has such a strong desire to protect and such a intimate desire to have the kids long and hope for things. Yet she's arguing with him at one point. She said, every decision I made has been for these children. Yet she's trying to keep that detachment up while still taking on her own responsibility for them too. Yeah. And so it's like a dichotomy, a battle within her.
Yeah. And then that eventually comes down at the end, like we said, that sometimes when we finally choose to love, it's when we feel it's safest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, C.S. Lewis tells us that's not love, you know? I mean, you know, that can grow into love. So we're not going to say that she never experienced love in the story, but it's self-interested love. It's a self-interested love that is only expressed when in a safe place, right? Yeah. And that safe place comes at the end of the story. You read the synopsis, I'm sure, and you saw that they make it to a sanctuary of sorts. And why is it a safe place? It's because everybody there is blind. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody can see, so they can't see the monsters who are driving everyone mad.
Which at one point it's kind of neat because it's the blind people who are able to selflessly save her and all these different people. Yet here she is at the end, and because she's in the sanctuary, they're never going to go outside again. Mm-hmm. They're separated from the chaos all around them, and maybe even the other people who are suffering in the midst of this. Here they are in the sanctuary, and they just say, okay, this is where I'm at. This is where I am now. And there's no like tremendous growth even in the main character of the story. It's just that she now names the children.
Right, right. And I didn't read the book, but I heard about the book that it's a much grislier ending. Is that they make it to the sanctuary, and you know, in the movie it's presented as it's a school for the blind, and so there were all these children who grew up to be adults who are blind, and that's why they could be safe from these monsters. But my understanding is that at the end of the book, it's actually more so people who have blinded themselves, literally gouged their eyes out to protect themselves.
That was my question, because when I heard that it was a group of blind people, it was in the movie, it's a blind school, but in reality, it's people who will just take out our eyes.
Yeah,
and we'll,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's about interest.
Yeah, yeah. But as you were mentioning, is that they make it to the sanctuary and there's no real resolution. You know, the evil is still out there. Evil has not been defeated. Yeah. It's only being deflected.
That's Father Tim Grumbach. I'm Timory Millington. We're talking about the movie Bird Box, is featured on Netflix, and I'll get to it in a second, but I actually chose not to watch the last half an hour of the movie. I had enough. I was done. I read the rest of the synopsis and left it at that. What made me finally re-watch the movie, though, this past week was because it's been a phenomenon. Like, I can't understand why so many people are obsessed with this movie. Now, Bishop Barron had one really interesting insight that led me to watch the movie in the end. He said, here's the story. And he said, here's what's clearly some sort of evil presence, but at no point in the story does anyone call upon God. And in fact, these, like whatever's possessing them, this monster, whatever it is basically causing them to look at their greatest fears and leads them to commit suicide. And so the whole story, to me, I'm looking around and going, this is all about suicide, destruction, and hopelessness, and truly a unexplained possessive presence that's leading people to commit suicide. This is demonic. Mm-hmm. And I finally hit a point where in the movie, a couple points where I said, no, I need a break. And I kept taking a break. And I text you at one point, like, I don't think I should be finishing this. But I feel like this movie was so centered on the demonic and still remaining almost in that hopeless place. And no, and I, okay, fine. They don't turn to God in the story, but it just seems kind of odd when there is this clear possession by the demonic.
And that's become really the motive of such entertainment, is that it'll show a very physical and real power of the demonic and of evil, but the God's presence is absent. Mm-hmm. Completely absent sometimes.
I wonder if this is why people are so obsessed with the movie, because I've not, you know, there are movies that come up now and again, and this is one of them. People have loved them. I wonder if part of the obsession is with the fact that the mystery of the demonic, it's never explained and there's no resolution. And so it's something unknown and mysterious. And so this natural desire for God and the mystery of who God is sort of present in the moment. And yet I feel like there's this demonic possession type of movie that's filling that space that they're trying to search for.
Yeah. And that's where the dictatorship of relativism came up for me in reflecting over this, is that, I know some people have had an experience of church where they feel like they can't question anything, and that God is a dictator king who has, set the rules for the world. And if you break the rules, you go to hell. If you think wrongly about God, you go to hell. And it's this dictatorship. But I feel like relativism is sort of taking on that dictatorship as well. And it makes itself clear in the way that many of these stories are being told, is that there's no origin of the evil is given, mm-hmm. and no resolution is given. All you're left is with the internal struggle of the characters. And there's something beautifully artistic about that. But it also leaves you with questions that cannot be answered by the storyteller. So each person must come up with their own interpretation, and it becomes isolating, and it becomes, you want an answer from the storyteller? You're not going to get it, because everyone has their own answer. And then there's no ultimate battle between good and evil. Evil's not vanquished. It's merely deflected. And, I was also thinking about the cross. When it comes to that idea of, is evil defeated or is it merely deflected? Mm-hmm. And there are some theologies of the crucifixion that focus on, God's wrath, that he had to kill something, he had to kill someone. But Jesus, oh, praise Jesus, he stepped in our way and protected us from the wrathful Father and deflected the sin, the wrath that sin deserves. I mean, that's divine child abuse is what that is. That's not the cross. And so to understand better what the cross is, we don't look at it as, God had to fulfill his wrath and so crushed his son in the place of us, and we're merely named justified, but that nothing has actually happened in our hearts and our souls, that we're still inherently sinful and inherently broken, and that's our very nature. That's not who we are. That's not what the cross is. Rather, something happened on that day. Something happened. Not just a renaming of who we are, but a recreation of who we are. And that's what we live out as a Catholic Church, through the sacramental life, through an understanding that the cross, was Jesus offering the perfect sacrifice to the Father, because only God could offer that sacrifice. And on behalf of us, he was able to do it so that every sacrifice we enter into, evil can be defeated, not merely deflected. And so that's what I'm seeing in this story is, evil's not defeated, it's merely deflected. And that's the default position of so much of our society, I'm afraid, is that evil, if it even exists, can merely be deflected.
Yeah, and that's the attitude people have. Well, and it makes me look at, you just told one of the most powerful stories, the story of the cross. And it makes me look to this story of this movie Bird Box that we're talking about on Netflix. And I'm reminded of the power of story. And story often used to be used to tell our history or to tell important lessons. Yet we've gotten to the point in society where we are obsessed with story, but just for the sake of story. There's no character development. And as you said, there's no battle of good versus evil in the movie. It's like the main character, Mallory, lives in the midst of all of this evil. She has no real character development. Normally, a good story would be there's good versus evil being battled. And the character may struggle, may fall at times, but one of the characters has some sort of growth in who they are. Yet instead, here the story ends. They're in their small little sanctuary. and no longer interacting with other people, and it's okay just being where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, you're okay the way you are. You know, it doesn't get to tell the great story of good versus evil. And they're attempting to tell us maybe the way that real life is in real life circumstances. But the reason we tell stories is to tell that great story, to invite people into that great story. We're not just here to tell you how life is, but how it could be.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
It's great to be with you in studio today. With me is Father Tim Grumbach, and we've been evaluating the movie Bird Box. So if you're just joining us, be sure to go and check out the episode at radiotrending.com. You can also view us on the live feeds. We're on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube today. Go check it out on social media. But I had mentioned before that I actually didn't finish watching the movie Bird Box, and I was really conflicted, and I think I had about an hour and a half in, and finally I'm like, I can't do this. There is such a demonic element to this movie. The whole story is about constant suicide being committed around you the entire time, which is just awful. Why would we watch a movie about so much suicide? Mm-hmm. It's not like it's a war of good versus evil and people are dying for the sake of a good cause. It's just they're being clearly possessed by what is like a demonic presence and they're dying. And again, it's not even a good story in the end. And so for me, that's Father Tim joining me today. I just kind of felt like we have to be more careful when we're looking to thrillers or suspense or entertainment, not to open that door of that demonic presence or that over curiosity even.
Yeah, and this could sound like we're being prudish, worrying too much about, oh, it's just make believe, it's just for fun, it's just for entertainment. But I've always been telling myself that the demons don't care if we're doing it for fun.
Yeah.
That they have an interest in our souls because they hate us.
Yeah, and that's why I didn't finish the movie. I went, I'm done. I'll read the synopsis so we can talk about it on the show. But I think that that's part of the cultural phenomena of the obsession with the movie Bird Box is the obsession with the demonic in some way.
Yeah, and we look at the way that entertainment has used the demonic is that it often shows the demonic as more powerful than God, or rather more present than God.
Yeah, and God's not even present in this movie. Yeah, yeah, I mean, you don't even see a holy medal. I thought the one medal that the main character, Tom, the Marine, had was going to end up being like some sort of Saint Michael medal in the end, but it's just some dumb symbol of circles.
A talisman, a good luck charm,
and, right?
But you look at movies going all the way back to like The Exorcist, is that, you know, it shows some kind of power in God and being able to cast out the demon some way, but ultimately the demon is more present than God. And that has just become a regular matter throughout many exorcist movies, demonic movies, is that the demonic is more present than the creator, than the one who has loved us into being, who even loved the demons into being, and that we can say that. But the presence of the demons is more powerful than the presence of God. It has become a regular thing in entertainment, and we're tempted to believe that in our daily lives.
And I'm really careful with what I watch. I don't watch horror movies specifically for this purpose, but I wasn't expecting that from Bird Box to have such a demonic element. And what's ironic is that everyone who mentioned the movie to me never really mentioned that type of theme in it. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really interesting, you know, I wouldn't have watched the movie if Bishop Barron hadn't kind of done a little commentary that made me curious. Mm-hmm. But it makes us question, what other areas in our life do we need to be more careful in when it comes to the demonic at times? Because we're living in a time where witchcraft is on the rise, mm-hmm. and exposure to things is just part of pop culture is going to increase, unfortunately.
And the demonic is not afraid to hide in order to get its work done.
Right.
Or even to work great powers, great miracles, as long as the person's heart is not converted. I was thinking about this because, you know, as of today, just yesterday was the Feast of Our Lady of Lourdes, is that how careful the church is in proclaiming miraculous these healings, because the demonic probably will, I believe, bring healing if it's going to be spiritually dangerous for a person. And what reason would God have for bringing physical healing without also desiring the healing of the heart, the healing of the soul? So just being aware of the way the demonic can find its way into our lives, even if, you know, just not us not being careful, and just letting these things into our lives. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were laughing about this when we were talking yesterday about my friends and I. You know, we love doing escape rooms. I'm no expert. I just kind of tag along whenever they go and I'm in town. And we often enjoy the escape rooms that are a little bit more like horror themed. And so if you've never seen an escape room before, it's kind of like being locked into a movie set. And the goal is to solve a bunch of riddles and puzzles in order to get from room to room and ultimately to find your way out of the room. And so you usually have about an hour to do it, and you can, you know, ask clues, but it's usually done quite well, and it takes a whole group effort to solve these riddles and these puzzles. Well, the last one that we did together, we knew it was going to be kind of horror themed. You know, I think it was called The Attic. And, you know, I don't want to give anything too much away as to, in case somebody wants to try that one out, but I wouldn't recommend it.
I say just spoil alert.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's kind of the etiquette of escape rooms is to not talk about what goes on in escape rooms. But this particular one did include having to discover the name of a demon in order to escape the room.
Oh, wow.
And the use of a Ouija board at the end of it. And, you know, when we realized, you know, we walked into one of the rooms and there's all these, you know, demonic things. There's a satanic pentagram. There's a cow skull on the wall. And my one friend who set this up for us, she was like, "I'm so sorry. I didn't know we were going to be doing this." And so just at the end of it, thought it was, why mess around with this stuff?
Yeah.
You know, it's even for fun, the demons don't care if we're just having fun calling on their names.
Yeah. You know, well, you shouldn't be anywhere near that.
Right.
If it were me personally in the situation, I'd be like, okay, I've never done one of these rooms, but it would be, okay, panic room, let me out.
Yeah. There is a panic button to get out. Yeah.
That would have been me.
But they're like, oh, we have a priest with us, so we'll be okay. So actually we went out, we finished the escape room with a minute to go. And we went outside and just prayed for a little bit on the sidewalk outside the place. And I did a minor exorcism. Which is, you know, not like a, you know, casting demons out, but just calling on God's protection when you take these things into your life. And it's a very powerful prayer, calling on Saint Michael, reminding Satan that he is crushed underneath the heel of our Lord and our Lady, just kind of freeing our hearts from whatever we might have taken on in that place without our consent. And actually praying over that escape room, saying, you know, Lord Jesus, if you need to close this place to protect souls, please do that. Yeah. But also look out for those who are working here. We're not trying to, you know, take away jobs and hurt employees, but just bring people to a knowledge of your truth and trusting that this stuff is not to be trifled with. So it's we've got to be very careful. And so I would have told you, you don't need to finish Bird Box because it's not that great a movie. But when you start to notice things like the demonic and you want to keep as far away from that, not being like, yeah, this isn't a matter of being too careful or too scrupulous.
And so I remember I texted him like, am I just being a wimp? Yeah.
And I said, no, it's just not that good a movie. But
I think exposure is important. Yeah. Like personally in your situation, I would have left. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was fine finishing the movie. Careful and aware, but someone who's more susceptible, no. And I think that's where just the exposure to begin with, we need to walk away from more often.
Yeah. I knew that we were going to be able to do a prayer out on the sidewalk afterwards and just kind of pray for conversion of heart for us and for those who went before us, those who will be going after us. Just an awareness of what it is that we're taking into our lives. I don't see that as being overly sensitive by any means. You know, this is the eternal battle that we are welcomed into in our spiritual lives, knowing that the victory has already been won. But, do we dapple with going across enemy lines without protection just for the sake of doing it? Yeah. No.
Well, it's a reminder that God conquers all. Mm-hmm. He does conquer evil. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of us cooperating, submitting ourselves to the sacraments and to the graces he has to offer so that we can walk without being afraid and without exposing ourselves to unnecessary things. That's Father Tim Grumbach. I'm Timory Millington. I want to talk, Father Tim, about some of the legal system here in the United States. We've hit a point over the last couple of weeks. We actually saw one member running for public office. I think it was one of the judges who was being grilled over the fact that, and excuse me, I've been a little out of the news the last couple of weeks with the wedding, but he was grilled over the fact that he was a Knight of Columbus, which I couldn't believe this. I mean, the Knights of Columbus are so willing to serve their pancake breakfasts, their mobile ultrasound fundraisers, like
fish fries.
Their service to the church. And yet they're finding him unfit potentially for office because of his association. This is something that that we're going to have to push back in our culture.
Yeah, and there's been a tremendous misunderstanding for decades now. You can almost point, you know, back centuries to what it means for a separation of church and state. Language, which, by the way, was never used at the beginning of the framing of the Constitution and the founding of our nation. It's something that has developed. And looking at the First Amendment, ultimately, it's not about protecting the state from religion. It's the opposite. It's protecting religion from the state. Mm-hmm. And so it's impossible by the framers' understanding and by natural law, as we'll see later on, that the church can break the First Amendment, that the church can be in violation of this separation of church and state, which has somehow become a wall. But rather, it was set in place so as to not promote and set up a state religion, so as to protect religion from the state.
Mm-hmm. And this is exactly why we saw, even in parts of the Europe kingdoms, right? In London, Europe, where they suddenly chose a universal religion for the people. And this is what we're saying. No, that's something we're not going to have here in the United States. I mean, this is the land of the free. And with that requires free worship of God.
Right. And, you know, going back to this idea of natural law and how the United States is so it's founded upon these basic understandings of natural law, not being the laws of nature, but what's built into us, what's built into creation by God himself. And so I've been actually reading through this this wonderful book called American Republic: Why America Will Perish Without Rome. And it's written by Timothy Gordon. And his most important line that he repeats over and over in the book is that America is a nation that is wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and currently functioning as secular. And so he dives into Catholic natural law and shows how the framers of the Constitution and the founders of the nation kind of plagiarized Catholic natural law, but because they were so anti-Catholic, did not want to use the fullness of it. And that's what's left us where we are as a nation.
We're going to come back talking about natural law and how fundamental it is to our nation and also to our work ethic. I'll pose this question: is raising your children with a good work ethic enough?
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Father Tim Grumbach of St. Augustine Parish in Los Angeles, the diocese, is here with me. And we've been talking about the movie Bird Box and our take on it. So if you didn't catch the episode, go head over to radiotrending.com for more on that. But I've posed this question earlier in the show: is raising your child with a good work ethic enough? Because I was with someone the other day and it really resonated that modern culture, I think a lot of parents let their kids get away with terror and have too much freedom. But there are also a lot of parents who really teach their kids to have a hard work ethic. They expect perfect grades, have to work really hard, perfect performance in sports. And I'm finding that then parents are celebrating as their kids have PhDs, are working 24/7, and have this fantastic life with all the money that they could ever want to travel anywhere they want. But is that the meaning and purpose of life?
Right. And that's an important question. It's like, is there even a meaning and a purpose in life? And, you know, I have the blessing to be able to do quite a bit of youth ministry and to, you know, walk with teens and with youth ministers and just see the stresses and the pressures that are put on them in life and in school. And we'll kind of chuckle to ourselves when a teen says, "Oh, I'm so stressed out." I'm like, "Okay, yeah, well, you know, get ready for real life." But this is a reality in their hearts. And it's something that we need to take very seriously spiritually, is the pressure put on these young people to perform at school and to perform well, especially by parents who might be a little too authoritarian and expecting so much of them, that I think we are raising a generation of young people who feel more pressure to be impressive than ever before, especially with the rise of social media and, you know, their expectation to be present and available and visible at all times and to show how impressive they are. It's really important that we can help our young people see that there is a purpose to work and work ethic that is more than success and more than impressiveness, and to really remind them of, you know, the great saints like, you know, Mother Teresa, who would say, I haven't been called to be successful. I've been called to be faithful.
Yeah. It's a man who dignifies work, not work that dignifies man. And that's where I think the problem lies, is when we raise people or we ourselves just have this hard work ethic ingrained within us, yet we forget that we work to live. We don't work to live. That's why I say it like that. But yet people think that we work to live. No. We don't work to, we have it very simple. We work to live. We don't live to work.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I keep throwing it out there because people have a hard time even understanding those words. We only work to do what is necessary so that we can live and live a full life and implement that element and idea into our life. And it's our dignity that brings dignity to the work that we do. It's the fact that a father must provide for his family. And that's the purpose behind the work that he does. Not just the fact that he's building a home or that he is a Marine or that he is a scientist.
Right. And our dignity comes from being sons and daughters of God. And I love these couple of days in the church here. We're looking through the stories of the creation. And so yesterday and today, when we're recording, is the Genesis 1 that we're going through and recognizing that, you know, God works for 6 days putting creation together, and then on the seventh day, he rests. And, you know, so there's kind of arguments between rabbis, you know, ancient rabbis of, you know, how many days did it actually take creation to happen, 6 days or 7 days? And, you know, some will say, well, 6 days, because that's how long God was working. You know, I'm more on the side that says, no, it took God 7 days to create the world because he worked for 6 days. And that rest day on the Sabbath is just as necessary to creation as anything that he put together. Mm-hmm. And you know, to remind us that we're not made to work.
Yeah,
we're made for the rest.
Well, and spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, people are burning out. And we have to look around us and say, what sustains you? What prevents that burnout? First and foremost is having an authentic prayer life and authentic faith. That's what prevents you. I mean, I look at some of the work we do in, you know, the transgender issue, the abortion issue. I would not be able to handle what I see and what I work with day in and day out if it weren't for my faith. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'll never forget in college, the idea of honoring the Lord's day and taking that day, right, of Sunday rest to worship God, but also to rest, to cultivate community, to have that time was so important. I remember in college, I made a big risk. I said, I'm no longer going to do homework on Sundays unless it's spiritual reading. It was one of the hardest decisions I made, but it was something that made a real difference of, you know what, God's going to duplicate your time when you honor him in those days. Not just that you're, you know, laying around on the couch, but that when you're truly honoring him and setting that time aside for him.
Yeah, it's a sacrifice of productivity. I think it's something that we all need to take to the end of our day as we're preparing to go to sleep for the night. Is, you know, that's one of the most important prayers that I make as I'm going to sleep, is to say, okay, God, I mean, I wish I could say, God, that I've been as productive as I possibly could be today, that I've been faithful to you all day long, but that I need to set that aside now and just rest, because that's what you desire for me at this moment. God, you have to take care of the rest in both of its meanings. You know, give me rest, but also take care of the rest of the stuff that I couldn't accomplish. And, you know, we need a place like that in our week, is to set aside, you know, our work because of the dignity of work, that, you know, we are not a slave to work, or at least we're not made to be slaves to work. And so that gives a dignity to work, but it comes from the dignity that we have as sons and daughters of God. But reading through this great book, Catholic Republic by Timothy Gordon, he points to the ways that, you know, labor has been almost deified. That's become something that has taken the place of the sacraments, knowing that in Catholic natural law, he gives us three pillars. Mm-hmm. The first of which is that creation is moral and it's free, is that we as human beings, as human persons, are created in such a way that there is morality in the world and we are free to choose it or choose against it. The second pillar is that creation is intelligible and we can understand it because we are intelligent. And then finally is that, you know, teleologically, is that creation has a purpose, has an end, you know, what Aristotle would call the final cause. It's something that everything that's created has an end to it, whether we look at sexuality or work, you know, or being a human person, is that we are made for something, we're made for an end. So work was made for an end.
So in summarizing those 3 points, you're saying in natural law, we understand that there's morality in all of culture, and that we have that ability to choose, which is such an important part of being human. And the intelligent side of it is that we can contemplate, understand everything that's around us. And finally, that there's a purpose, whether it's to our sexuality, to marriage, to family life, a purpose to our work. And that's where I think we're losing ourselves. So many people are raising their children today with a hard work ethic. And that's where you find yourself in your 30s or 40s. Yet you find yourself maybe single, wishing you had married or had children when you were fertile. You know, maybe you didn't put enough time into your marital relationship and now it's suffering, you know, all these different circumstances. And that's because so many people have placed their worth in a hard work ethic. And so I think reevaluating where our mindsets are and why we work, why we do what we do, is very important.
Yeah. And the suggestion is that because, you know, the United States is wired Catholic, that so much of what the Declaration and the Constitution, their founding is based on Catholic natural law, in a sense. You look at it historically, it reaches into the natural law, but doesn't go quite far enough. And what has happened over the centuries is that we have become a desacralized nation, is that we need the sacraments to experience that grace, you know, within the families, within our individual persons, in order to bring us into the community that we believe as a Catholic Church, we are built into the body of Christ. And if we're living in a society that's not being built into the body of Christ, then something is missing. And so, with a lot of, as it's suggested, Calvinist tendencies towards theology and living as church, living as community, when you lose the sacraments in that Calvinistic worldview, humans still desire the grace that can be poured through the sacraments. Mm-hmm. And so what is suggested is that they found that here in Americanistic tendencies in work. And so work has been deified. Work has been made sacred in place of, if that were possible, in place of the sacraments. So the only real sacraments that our country has is a hard work ethic. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have a meaning other than work hard and you'll be successful.
You know, as we're talking about this, Father Tim, it makes me think about the importance of, yes, keeping everything in context, but what keeps our work in context? It's that examination of conscience at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's the offering of our day at the beginning of the day, recognizing I'm offering my day for these intentions, for these people. I'm offering my work for this, all of the suffering I will endure. And that's forming a contemplative spirit, which is why I just want to briefly mention Eagle Eyes Ministries has a program called the Ecclesia Institute, and they're rebooting it this summer. It's for young adults, and it's about a month-long formation program where you're living the monastic lifestyle with the community of St. John. You're going through theology and philosophy classes and different activities, but it's forming you to be prepared for what God is calling you to live as saints in the world today, but to not be of it, to not allow it to define you. So go ahead and check out eagleeyeministries.org. I'll be sure to tweet that out as well. And I want to shout out Father Tim. I'll be speaking in a couple different places. So if any of you guys are nearby, shout out to everyone. I'll be speaking up in Fresno Diocese. I'll be speaking also out in Texas, El Paso in a couple weeks, and I will also be at Knott's Berry Farm next month. So go ahead and head over to my social media, check it out, because I would love to see you wherever I'm going to be that you guys are as well. What's coming up in your realm as well, Father?
Weddings and parish stuff. I'm actually not making too many of the rounds right now, not until the summer. Okay. But when the summer comes, I'll also be in Texas awesome. for a week with Life Teen and some different events throughout. But that's really the biggest thing that's coming up forward right now for me.
So if you want to send your young people to a Life Teen camp that Father Tim will be at, please check out Life Teen summer programs. It's time to start looking at that. I'll also mention Vox Vitae summer program, among other ideas. If you've enjoyed the show, I'm Timmy Millington. You can find me at radiotrending.com. Leave a comment and share this episode. Father Tim will be back in just a couple weeks.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To book her to speak or learn more about her guest, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.